Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's April the 17th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Right, quite a bit to talk about this week, as you can imagine, and hopefully we'll have a guest on later who we can netter with about some of the past week's events, but we'll see. One thing, because we do have so much to talk about this week, and because we have a guest coming in, this will not be RFN's official Hitler's Birthday podcast. What with what I just mentioned that we need to discuss, plus a lot of stuff that's happening here over the next week, I'm going to be really rushed, and so we'll hold off on the Hitlerian commentary and music until next week. I will try to upload that podcast maybe as early as next Monday, but I won't promise anything. First off, I'm sorry to disappoint the goat dancing crowd, but this show is not going to be one long dish on Fraser Glenn Miller. I have already said everything I have to say about Miller many years ago in an internet article I wrote, which was then plagiarized by some anonymous individual and combined with a much larger document entitled A Brief History of the White Nationalist Movement, which some of you may have heard of and which you can probably find online somewhere if you are one of these people that is just absolutely fascinated by this stuff. What the late Dr. William Pierce referred to as that unhealthy fascination. There are still about four people on the internet who are left over from the nutty 90s who have been driven around the twist by this document and who are still screaming and screaming and screaming about it on blogs that get about 6 hits per week. Now, before you ask, no, I will not send you my own Glenn Miller article, because I'm no longer interested in keeping alive anything to do with the nutty 90s. Now, although Miller does more appropriately belong to the crazy 80s, I consider him to be part of the whole nutty 90s scene. Now, you might say his little stunt back in 1987 kicked off the nutty 90s just as the breakup of the National Alliance after Pierce's death finally ended the nutty 90s sometime around 2003 or 2004 or so. When that happened, what began was what I suppose might be called the age of the internet, or the age of the V-bulletin boards. And except for the Northwest Front, that's where we are today. And it looks like that's where we're going to stay until all the old men like me fade away, probably along with the rest of the white race. The 90s was a very long decade, movement-wise. It lasted about 16 years. And of course, for some among us, it still is, and always will be, the year 1996. However, I have no intention of prolonging that extended decade. And I'll say this much, if we needed any more proof, which we didn't, I have to state that from this point on, anyone who posts anything at all on VNN has got rocks in their head. VNN is the most heavily monitored racial website in the world. You might just as well send a copy of anything you post there directly to the FBI and the Southern Poverty Law Center. After Yankee Jim and Joe Snuffy and now Rounder, the place seems to be a breeding ground for lunatics and weirdos. Alex Linder seems to have some kind of cyber kiss of death thing going on at VNN, and I simply don't get why we seem to be incapable of understanding that fact and steering clear of him. But then we've never been able to learn that particular lesson. I find it absolutely gobsmacking that there are people in our wee little subculture who still defend Miller and Kevin Alfred Strom and Craig Cobb and certain others who have fucked up so badly that if they had any real concern for the welfare of white nationalism and the white race as a whole, they would understand that the very best thing they could do, the only thing they could do for us anymore, would be to stay the hell away from us and never again allow their name to be associated with us in any manner. But the movement is like potato chips. It's addictive. And once you're hooked, you just can't stay away. Now, this has always been a problem with us. Former members and associates and leaders who have done bad things, have completely blotted their copybooks, and yet who hang on like grim death, and whom we cannot ever seem to get rid of, if only because the media won't allow it. I mean, Glenn Miller testified against his own people in not one but two, count them two, capital cases, death penalty cases, and then spent almost 10 years in the Federal Witness Protection Program. Why in God's name did Alex Linder let him anywhere near VNN? I've never understood that. Okay, enough. Now on to the much more significant events at the Bundy Ranch in Nevada, or better yet, if our guest shows up, like I hope he will, he and I will just bat the breeze about it. So, tell you what, I'll fill out this first segment with our usual guests and reserve the rest of the show for me and him and for my own closing tirade.
This is what a loony lefty, or a Quaker, has said about the Jews. There is a great danger for the United States of America. That danger is the Jew. Gentlemen, in whichever land the Jews have settled, they have depressed the moral level and lowered the degree of commercial honesty. They have created a state within a state, and when they are oppressed, they attempt to strangle the nation financially, as in the case of Portugal and Spain. For more than 1,700 years, they have lamented their sorrowful state, namely that they were driven out of their motherland. But, gentlemen, if the civilized world today should give them back Palestine as their property, they would immediately find pressing reasons for not returning there. Why? Because they are vampires, and cannot live on other vampires. They cannot live among themselves. They must live among Christians and others who do not belong to their race or their religion. At the time of the first congressional convention in Philadelphia, Benjamin Franklin said, "If they are not excluded from the United States by the Constitution, within less than 100 years, they will stream into our country in such numbers that they will rule and destroy us, and change our form of government, for which Americans have shed their blood and sacrificed life, property, and personal freedom. If Jews are not excluded within 200 years, our children will be working in the fields to feed the Jew, while they remain in the counting house, gleefully rubbing their hands. I warn you, gentlemen, if you do not exclude the Jew forever, your children's children will curse you in your grave. A leopard does not change his spots. They should be excluded by the Constitution. Not all Jews practiced the Babylonian Talmud, but back in 1776, there was no such thing as Reformed Judaism. Ethiopian and Samaritan Jews have only been recently discovered, who do not practice the Talmud. In the Talmud, it teaches that a Jew is not required to practice morality towards the Gentile. Not to practice morality towards all is utterly stupid. Eventually the whole world will come to the knowledge of their tribal morality and will come to hate them. The righteous hate the wicked, and no amount of legislation can change that. The population will instead end up hating the politicians who were so stupid as to think you can prevent the righteous from hating the wicked. Jews run Sin City, known as Vegas. Republicans, and that includes Mitt Romney, may as well be bowing down to Satan, because they all went to Vegas to bow down to the richest Jew in Vegas. The Bible calls the Jews the synagogue of Satan, Now, if the Mormons do not excommunicate Mitt Romney for bowing down to Satan, then the reputation of the Mormons will be in the toilet. Years ago, the Catholic Church thought it was above righteousness, for a cardinal said to a German monk, "The Pope is above Scripture." Well, the name of that monk was Martin Luther. The priesthood of the Mormon Church is not above righteousness, and if the leadership of the Mormon Church condones Mitt Romney bowing down to Satan, then thousands of Mormons will abandon the Mormon Church. God of righteousness is no more on the side of the Jew now than it was in 70 AD when the Romans came and destroyed Jerusalem. Christians who have supported the immoral state of Israel have made themselves apostates in the sight of the world, yearning for righteousness. Jews are a bunch of gangsters, the gods of the underworld. Time says it is the time for the revenge of Rachel Corrie. Peace means thou shalt not covet. But Israel has coveted the West Bank and Gaza and even killed an American. Then also, what about the Liberty, back during the Six-Day War? Jehovah's Witnesses are a Bible-based religion that believes that the Bible is the Word of God and that the Bible says that the Jews are the synagogue of Satan, whereas the Zionist Christians are listening to money or world events instead of God's words, so in the end, they will prove themselves to be apostates. Global hatred of the Jew is coming. Hitler said, "My spirit shall arise from the ashes of Berlin, and I shall prove to be right."
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to discuss the work of Kirk Eggers. The particular book I'm discussing is The Birth of the Millennium. Now, Eggers was an SS warrior poet, you might say, and he was very interested in the lost law of the North, and he calls that an absolute law. Now, when I think about this law and the way that he writes it, it really reminds me of the Aerodharma book. Because he wants to talk about the eternal natural law and the process of awakening. Now, he talks about the first truly modern author as being Nietzsche, and how Nietzsche captured this sense of heroic realism and the sense of the German essence. Even though, in some respects, the German essence is for Germany alone, Eggers says that the world will owe a debt to Germany. And he talks a bit about German history and how he feels that Christianity has misused the warrior spirit in foreign wars. For example, he dislikes Charlemagne, that he calls an imperialist, and talks about the struggle of Germany against Rome and praises the poverty of Prussia, which he says to a certain discipline to northern Germany. He talks about this notion of party and how party is different from selection, because party is about popularity and selection is about concern for the community, and the difference between things such as creative unrest versus the bustle of a city, for example. Now, one of the interesting points that he makes about the nationalist revolution is that he says that the revolution is ever new. So in contrast with this idea of there being a revolution and then it becoming a bureaucracy, he says that the natural law, which is the true spirituality, is a sense of constant motion, and so there's never a danger of this becoming old. The awakened individual is always going to be anchored in the divine order. And he says that piety should lead Germans back to the true faith that will be entered by neither Christians nor communists. Now, he says that Germany has warned all whites, but that it gets only hostility, but that Germany will have a rulership for the good of all. He says that in this new millennia, there will no longer be a need for any idolatry of any kind, whether to some sort of religion or whether to tradition or to old ideas. He says that age is revered only as it is one with the idea and the reality. And Eggers talks about the northern idea of fate and how it's linked to responsibility, and how those on the path of the aware life will never tire in the struggle, and in fact, they'll have the key to all knowledge, especially knowledge of the natural world. The lawful person will be eternally the executor of the nation's total will, and that the total state is not going to be hung up in petty morality. Rather, it's going to be practical, and it's going to be a good gardener, allowing the strong to thrive. It's going to use such things as sterilization, for example, and there's going to be a Lebensborn program, because it's going to be about practicality, and it's going to be about the big picture. And in doing this, it's going to take on the odium of unpopularity. Essential persons are going to rule, and this total nation is going to have respect for all other peoples. It's not imperialistic, but it's also going to have respect for the law, for this eternal law. And it's going to be this new homeland community that's going to be, as he said before, free of all idols, but it's going to be bound by law, and as such, it will be hated and persecuted. But it's not going to be a threat to spirituality. And in fact, neither will it be a threat to personality. Personalities will develop within the law, and they will be used to their fullest extent. The people of this new millennium will take being over appearance. Reality and divinity will be one thing. So at the end of the book, Eggers leaves us with a choice. He writes a poem, and he talks about going to battle in the light or dying in the shadow. And so this is the stark choice that he leaves us with in this book full of insights. And so I would really recommend you get one of these books, and I've already ordered two more of the Kirk Eggers series because I've been very impressed with what he writes. So thank you very much for listening, and hail victory, comrades.
Tell you what, in order to fill out the segment here, here's an old clip from a Charles Lindbergh speech from one of my Aryan history programs that I just happen to have lying around the hard drive. I think this is from the early 40s.
I come before you at this time to enter a plea for American independence. It is amazing that one should have to plead for American independence in a nation with a heritage such as ours. In a nation which in its infancy revolted against foreign control, and whose people have fought time and time again against the armies and interference of the old world. Yet the independence and the destiny of America were never more in jeopardy than they are today. Why, with 130 million people, are we being told that we must give up our independent position, that our frontiers lie in Europe, and that our destiny will be decided by European armies fighting on European soil? What has happened to this nation that it fears in maturity the forces that it conquered in its youth? What change has come over us? What foreign influence has sprung up among us? Where is the blood of such leaders as Washington, Jefferson, and Lincoln? Blood that stood firm on American soil against the threats the armies and the navies of the greatest empires on earth. What we lack today is the type of leadership that made us a great nation. We do not question the need for rearmament, for reform, for a better economic system. What we do question is the leadership that has brought these conditions upon us. We question that the men who were unable to see these conditions in time to avoid them, who could not foresee the war in time to prepare for it, who refused to believe the reports of rearming abroad when there was still time for action, are now competent to carry this nation successfully through a period of great crisis. Under their leadership, we have alienated one after another the most powerful military nations of both Europe and Asia. At a time when we ourselves are unprepared for action, and while the people of our nation are overwhelmingly opposed to war. There is no question about the fundamental courage and solidarity of Americans when our national welfare is at stake. There is no division among us about the defense of our own country. We have always been ready to fight against the interference of foreign powers in our affairs. If need be, we are ready to die for the independence of America, as our forefathers have died before us when necessity arose. On a clearly American issue, we stand a united nation. It is only when we are asked to take part in the quarrels of foreign countries that we divide. Only when we are asked to merge our destiny with that of foreign lands. Only when an attempt is made to transfer loyalty for America to loyalty for some other nation. The fact is today that we are divided. We have not confidence in our leaders. We have not confidence in their efficiency or in their judgment. Instead of a Washington warning us against the wiles of foreign influence and excessive partiality for any nation, we are told that our frontiers lie in Europe. We do not need untold thousands of military aircraft unless we intend to wage a war abroad. What we do need is a thoroughly modern and efficient Air Corps, trained, equipped, and maintained for the specific mission of American defense. What we need even more, however, is balanced action, a clear-cut plan, and a consistent attitude. Adequate defense does not necessitate this alarm and confusion. With intelligent leadership, we could have built an impregnable defense for America without disturbing seriously our national life and industry. We have already spent more than enough money to have done this. With an army, a navy, and an air corps of high quality and reasonable size, we could have maintained our position with safety at home and respect abroad. But today, while we listen to talk of aircraft, guns, and battleships, couched in figures so astronomical that they compare only with our national debt, we find ourselves in confusion at home and under ridicule abroad. All the lessons of Europe have passed unheeded before us. The effort that should have been devoted to the welfare of our own nation has been spread ineffectively over difficulties of the other parts of the world. The attention that should have been concentrated on the defense of America has been divided by a controversy over what part we should take in the wars of Europe. If we desire strength and freedom and independence for our country, the first step must be to assure ourselves of leadership which is entirely and unequivocally American. When a man is drafted to serve in the armed forces of our country, he has the right to know that his government has the independent destiny of America as its objective, and that he will not be sent to fight in the wars of foreign lands. The doctrine that we must enter the wars of Europe in order to defend America will be fatal to our nation if we follow it. When men are called upon to fight and die for their country, there must not be even the remotest question of foreign influence involved.
And for first music break, here is a German group called Rote Sand, and the song has the charming title of We Will Kill Them All. I dedicate that one to Glenn Miller, but somehow I don't think the FBI guys who are listening would kind of see the humor. Well, I promised you a guest, and this is Comrade Charles Martel from Montana, and he hasn't been on here for quite a while now, but he was passing through town, and I was able to persuade him to sit down and have a word with us. One quick thing I want to say before we get into it about Half an hour after I signed off last, had a knock on the door, had a couple of FBI agents standing there wanting to talk to me about Glenn Miller. This time they sent a couple of young white males. I suppose maybe they figured that I would be more disposed to speak to them, which I wasn't. This one kid looked like he was just barely old enough to shave. Actually, he looked a little bit like the character of Sweets on the TV series Bones. I don't know if any of you people watch that. But anyway, I asked them if they had a warrant, and they said they did not. And so I said, come back when you get one, and I closed the door in their faces. Now, that's how it's supposed to go.
Okay, did you want to say anything?
Yeah, well, I don't have much to say, you know, just some kind of something in the news. So who knows what's going on.
Right. I haven't actually seen the man for 30 years. Interestingly enough, in 1985, when the FBI came around looking for me to his house, Mr. Miller did not return the favor. I was in Ireland at the time, and he not only told them where I was, he gave them my address. So I kind of returned good for bad there, but this is just a matter of policy. I don't speak to the FBI about anything unless there's some specific reason to do so. I did once when the Joint Terrorism Task Force came around here, but I was trying to find out whether or not they were seriously trying to connect us to the Bionic Backpack in Spokane. They were not. They were just fishing, and so I terminated that interview. But anyways, that's what's going on around the old homestead these days.
Well, you know, it's a sad state of affairs when busily chasing people like us around, when thousands and thousands of white people are being murdered and raped and robbed and victimized all the time, and nobody seems to worry about that. It never makes the headlines.
I don't think the FBI was ever called in on the so-called knockout game, which I suspect is still going on. It's just the media isn't allowing us to hear about it.
Well, obviously, to get the FBI or the authorities interested in you, you have to be a certain selected ethnic group or religion or whatever. Otherwise, don't bother to call them.
Mm-hmm. Before you came, Charles, I did a little piece up front about some of the things that have been going on this week. I mentioned Miller, but I was going to get into this thing in Nevada, which I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with that.
Okay.
A friend of mine that worked with me when I was over here living in Washington sent me an email and said he thought he saw my face in the crowd down there. So I don't know why he'd think I would be there.
You must be some kind of extremist or something.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, I grew up on a cattle ranch, so I'm really familiar with this whole BLM stuff. And really, it's a racket. These guys farm this land or ranch it for hundreds of years, and then the BLM just comes in and takes it away from them. That's not all that unusual, actually.
Yeah. This Bundy family had had the lease on that particular stretch of land since 1887. And now they're getting their cattle stolen because apparently the cattle are going to step on spotted tortoises or something if they go on that land or some BS. Apparently, from what I can find out on the internet, it started out as a straight extortion attempt on the part of the federal government. They were demanding $1 million off this guy Bundy of so-called range fees that he hadn't paid. And then somebody finally pointed out that in the first place, this wasn't federal land anyway. It was state land, belonged to the state of Nevada. So I'm not quite sure what the federal government was doing, charging a private rancher fees for grazing his cattle on land that didn't belong to them. But then again, that's our government. And then when basically this Bundy guy told them to piss off, they stole his cattle.
Well, I got nothing good to say for the BLM, so I better leave it at that.
Right. Well, anyway, what kind of concerns me, though, is this thing that I'm seeing on the internet about how we won some kind of victory down there. Temporarily, yes. Also, I'm sure the fact that InfoWars exposed the fact that Harry Reid's son was involved in a corrupt land deal with the Chinese over that same stretch of land probably didn't help. And apparently the BLM has backed off, and I've even heard that they've actually returned the cattle. But what I think is going to happen there is at some point in the next few months, they're going to convene a quiet little grand jury there in Las Vegas or someplace, and they're going to hand down secret indictments, and not only the Bundy family, but all of those so-called militia leaders that came out to Nevada to help them out are going to find themselves charged with mob action or intimidating federal officers or square dancing in a roundhouse or some bullshit. And there's going to be a series of midnight raids. They've learned a little bit from Waco and from Ruby Ridge. They backed down, but you remember the Ed and Lorraine Brown, that incident when they,
in
New Hampshire? Yeah.
Yeah, I remember those guys.
Well, what they did there was they snuck agents in really close to the family and got them real close so the family trusted them and then jumped on them one day when they were off their guard. So they have learned a little bit about dealing with situations like that. But the trouble is the federal government can't allow any white citizen to be perceived to have defeated them or backed them down in any way. It'd be very, very bad for their morale and fatal for their image of being all-powerful, blah, blah, blah. They can't afford to let any of us win or be perceived to win. So I think Harry Reid himself was right. This isn't over. Basically, the federal government decided not to use brute force, but they're just going to get sneaky about it. I really would not want to be that Bundy family because they got the crosshairs on their back now.
Yeah, that's true. But the unpleasant fact is that the government's always been pulling these kind of stunts. In the old days, it's just that there was no resistance. They just come out and file a lien on you they just ran roughshod over the ranchers, telling them how many cows they could run and when they could run them and raising their fees if they felt like it. But at least they didn't come out and shoot you if you didn't pay your fees, right? And it was a slow thing. They'd go through the courts or whatever like that. This kind of SWAT team action is pretty chilling. But what it really means is, you know, the government's finally just decided that they don't want to mess around going through the sham of the courts. They're just going to come out with a small army and shoot you and take your land if they feel like it. Mm-hmm. The federal government's always been this way. But, man, they're just coming out of the closet like crazy. That's what concerns me.
Mm-hmm. Well, they have discovered that they can do anything they want to do to anybody that they want to do it to, and that they are operating with no accountability of any kind. No one is going to do anything about it. Obama should have been impeached the minute he instituted that so-called DREAM Act by executive order after Congress had rejected it twice. That is a clear violation of the Constitution, but nobody's got the balls to impeach him. He's the first baby shit brown president. And so it's like a dog that starts killing chickens. That's why he has to be put down, because once he finds out that he can do it, he'll never stop. Obama and the government have now discovered that no one is going to do anything at all to them, whatever they do. Like the FBI murdered that poor Chechen bastard in Orlando, locked him in his apartment for 8 hours and tortured him and beat on him and then shot him 6 times in the chest and 1 shot in the back of the head to finish him off. And they were, of course, clear. The FBI investigated thoroughly and cleared themselves. So, no, this happened about 2 months ago.
Really?
It actually happened May of last year, but the actual clearing, you know, happened. And things like what happened with Jeff Hughes, our own friend up there in Vancouver, Canada. Some female officer pumps 10 slugs into him. She gets sent to Ontario. He doesn't get a coroner's inquest until, you know, like 2 years later. It's absurd. When you have a government that understands they can do anything and nothing will be done about it, that's when you've got tyranny.
Well, nobody's going to impeach Obama because he's doing exactly what he's been told to do. I mean, the only reason they acted like they were going to impeach Clinton is they wanted him to do something he really didn't want to do. Whatever, I think that they wanted him to invade some country. But anyway, they were just teaching him a lesson and all the other politicians that if you didn't toe the line, that they'd take you out. And so after that, Clinton was Mr. Yes, sir, how high, sir. The president is a figurehead. They don't have any real power. They just do what they're told. Because like Clinton, if they don't do what they're told, they're going to be out in a heartbeat.
Speaking of invading foreign countries, do you think Obama or the people running him are actually insane enough to go to war with Russia or with the Ukraine?
I think they're insane enough. I mean, they're chomping at the bit to invade Iran and Russia or whatever. I mean, they don't care. But of course, they're not soldiers. What's holding them back are the generals themselves. I mean, they stacked the deck with a bunch of yes, sir, generals. But the problem is the generals can see that it's impossible. There's no way in hell that we can invade Iran, let alone Russia. So that's what's holding them back.
My understanding is that Obama actually wanted to attack Syria and try and invade Syria to overthrow Bashar and put apparently an al-Qaeda faction in power. Which makes a hell of a lot of sense. But at some point, some of the generals in the Pentagon sat him down and said, hey, Barry, we need to have a talk. Basically, the United States military right now, frankly, isn't in any shape to go up against even Syria. And Russia, of course, was protecting Syria with a missile screen and whatnot, so they couldn't really declare a no-fly zone. And Obama backed off. But now everyone is screaming about Russia. Always look at who the Jews hate. And right now the Jews are going after Russia, hammer and tongs. Of course, they always did hate the Russians. But I would really like to be a little fly on the wall when the generals sit down and have a talk with Barack Obama about the advisability of invading Russia.
I mean, hey, yeah, no, wait. We invaded Afghanistan, and they said, there's no way. Nobody has ever succeeded in conquering Afghanistan since Alexander the Great. They've kicked everybody's ass for the last, 2,500 years. Oh, and then we set up the Mujahideen to run the Russians out, the great cost of the Russians, which actually is what broke the Russian Empire. Mm-hmm. And then our leaders are so brilliant, they fell in this very same trap that they'd laid for the... I mean, that's crazy.
Now we're fighting the same Mujahideen.
Right, exactly. I mean, we lost that war. We lost Iraq. We've lost every war we've been in since World War II.
Yeah. And I cannot see how anybody can possibly spin that mess in Iraq as a victory.
No, it's not. It's not a victory. Are you kidding me?
Well, the neocons claim it was. And they go, well, we got Saddam. No, actually, we didn't even get Saddam. We posted a huge reward. And the Kurds turned him in for money. And then we handed him over to his tribal enemies to kill him because we didn't have the balls to do it ourselves.
Well, we, if you're talking about the United States,
yeah,
we did not.
Force of habit, sorry.
The United States lost the war, but the people that wanted the war won the war because they just took out one more enemy of Israel. I mean, they don't really care if they kick our asses and kill all of our soldiers. What they want is to destabilize the country so it's not a threat to the Holy Land. whatever those people think they are.
But that, I think, will be very interesting to see if they start trying to gin up interest in a war on Russia with the country and the state it's in today. I mean, this is a country that can't even set up a functioning website.
Well, not to slightly change the subject, but I just read this great article somewhere. It was talking about how crazy it is for the Israelis to want us to take out Iran because they might get a nuclear weapon and then they might drop it on somebody. And the guy is one of these real patriotard type pundits. So anyway, he was going on about it would be terrible if the Muslims got an atomic bomb because they were so crazy they'd drop it on somebody. And then the guy just casually pointed out that there's lots of nuclear powers in the world, but nobody has ever used them because it's too horrible except the Americans in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And if I think about that, they're all worried about the Muslims going crazy and dropping a bomb on somebody. And we're the only, the Americans, I hate to say we, the American government is the only government that actually used nuclear weapons, and they did it on civilian populations as usual. So you got a lot of guys, you got a lot of dang gall pointing the finger at the Iranians.
Well, if I was the president of Iran or North Korea or any of these little countries that the United States has a 2-minute hate on for, I would want a nuclear weapon basically to keep those crazy Americans and their bombers out of my skies, because you note that, okay, ever since North Korea got their nuclear weapons, as crude as they are, nobody messes with them anymore. And none of these threats to invade and reunite them with the South by force. And now, since the Pakistanis got the bomb, all of a sudden they are our allies in the great fight against terrorism. Bullshit they are. They're actually sheltering the Taliban on their side of the border, but nobody dares point this out because Pakistanis are immune. Because they've got the bomb and they're, in essence, immune to the ultimate form of blackmail. So if I was Iran, I would want a bomb. So, and I can't help but think that if Saddam had been successful in getting his bomb and the Israelis hadn't bombed that one reactor in Iraq in, what was it, 79? Anyway, if Saddam had had a bomb, neither the Gulf War nor the great Iraq attack of 2003 would ever have happened.
No
one would have dared. That's why these little third and second rate powers want nuclear weapons, is to keep the damned Americans off their back. They're not scared of the Russians.
Right. And that's why everybody in the Middle East wants a bomb, to keep the Israelis, Israelites off their
Israel.
Back.
Yes. Yeah.
Anyway, it's just crazy. You ever see that cartoon where the Uncle Sam has got this Hebrew on his back? You know, the old classic guy
with the big
black hat. Yeah. And he's got a bit in Uncle Sam's teeth, and he's got the reins, and then Uncle Sam's got blinders on like a workhorse. And he's just driving him, you know? And that's exactly what they're doing. You know, we're just a golem for those people. And that's what people are afraid of in the Middle East and the Muslims. The only reason there are all these radical Muslims running around is because we created them when we backed Israel. If we hadn't have backed Israel, the Arabs were actually our allies.
Up until World War I, Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, exactly. And after World War II, they supported us. If we would have treated them fairly, we wouldn't have any of this baloney with all these radical Muslims.
Well, we hadn't dumped all those damn Jews on them.
Yeah, exactly. What do you expect them to do?
Well, you know, Mark Twain visited Palestine in the 19th century, and he says, look, this is a backwater. Nothing happens here. This idea that, well, they've been fighting there for centuries. No, they haven't. Well, World War I, there was a bit of a war in Palestine between the Turks and the Allies, but that was something from outside. The actual violence between Arabs and Jews started in 1929 when the Jews moved in on Hebron and tried to take that, and the Arabs finally said, no, we had enough, and they chased the Jews out of Hebron. That was the beginning of the so-called modern Middle East conflict, again, which involved the Arabs trying to defend their land against outside invaders. This is one of those lilac, new agey type groups. I don't know the name. Whoever sent this to me neglected to give it, or I neglected to save it, whatever. In case you're wondering what the weird lyrics mean, what they're talking about here is making whiskey, and the song is called John Barleycorn.
There were three men came out of the west, their fortunes for to try. And these three men made a solemn vow, John Barleycorn must die. They ploughed, they sowed, they harrowed him in, throwing clods upon his head. And these three men made a solemn vow, John Barleycorn was dead. They let him lie for a very long time, till the rain from heaven did fall. Then little Sir John threw up his head, so amazed them all. They let him stand till the midsummer day, till he grew both pale and wan. Then little Sir John grew a great long beard, and so became a man.
Anyway, on another topic entirely, since we're just sitting here bullshitting, how's your Obamacare situation without identifying yourself? And anyway, but how's Obamacare shaping up out there in Montana?
Well, it depends on who you are, strangely enough. Mm-hmm. If you're just a regular working class stiff, I mean, and these are actual stories I've heard. Mm-hmm. They're either jerking your insurance completely, just canceling it, or they're like doubling the premiums, mm-hmm. or they're jacking them up. Like one kid told me that his deductible went from like $2,000 to $5,000 by fiat. You know, horror stories like that. Everything's costing a heck of a lot more. And everybody's terrified that if they don't get this insurance by whatever the deadline is.
It's already expired. Oh, well. March 31st. They're screwed, yeah.
I mean, people come to me all the time asking me if they're going to get screwed or sent to jail and all that stuff. But then this guy walks in and, well, he works, but I assume he works under the table. But, you know, he's an able-bodied guy. He looks like he hasn't missed any meals. So he suddenly announces that he tried to get Obamacare off of the internet, and it was going to cost him $250 a month, which I thought was pretty cheap from what I was hearing.
Yeah.
But then he was directed to the Obamacare storefront, which mm-hmm. is in downtown where I live. He went down there, and after the experts there went through all the options, he got his Obamacare for $12 a month. I mean, I swear to God, that's what he told me. So I advise everybody to see if there isn't some kind of Obamacare storefront where they purposely cater to the dispossessed.
Right. Well, it's probably basically what that is the Democrat Party buying votes.
Yeah.
I actually tried, just out of curiosity, I'd already decided that I was just going to mm-hmm. pay the fine, but I have never yet been able to even get a price. Here in Washington, we had a separate website. It wasn't the healthcare.gov, but it was like run by the state, but I could never get onto it. I tried 8 times, and it wouldn't even let me set up an account, but I was able to get a half-assed price quote from Kaiser Permanente, or from Kaiser Healthcare, I think it's called now, big HMO, and the best estimate I could get from them was that for a man of my age who has no government dependencies at all. I'm not on food stamps. I'm not on welfare. It's like, you know, I have nothing to prove that I'm poor, so to speak. And my income tax returns show that I'm self-employed. Anyway, so the best I could hope for was $751 a month, which there's just simply no way that I could afford that. So I'm going to have to continue to pay whatever the fine is because, I mean, I can't come up with $751 every month. And millions of people have now lost their insurance and they can't get any more until next year.
Right.
And what I'm saying is that a nation this incompetent wants to go to war with Russia?
No, Obamacare isn't going to work. You can't have a single payer system and universal insurance like they got in Canada and, you know, other socialist states if more people are taking out of the system than are putting into the system. Mm-hmm. The numbers just don't add up. Mm-hmm. It kind of reminds me of my dad's favorite book. It was called How to Get Rich Through Deficit Spending. Yeah. It was 500 blank pages. Okay. Yeah. So, but the thing of it is, it won't work. And so already the medical establishment is killing the country. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's taking a bigger bite out of the GDP mm-hmm. every year. And I mean, it's rivaling the military for gobbling. In fact, I think it's bigger than the military, actually, the medical industry.
1/6 of the American economy.
Yeah, they suck up an incredible amount of money. And the thing is, people are getting sicker. More and more people are wanting more and more expensive treatments. In fact, somebody was just telling me the other day, I think it was yesterday, that they have a pill now for some disease. I forget what it is. And the pill costs $1,000 for each mm-hmm. pill. Mm-hmm. And of course, everybody that's on Medicare or whatever, any kind of government program, will get that paid automatically. And most insurance companies are already screaming bloody murder because they're being pinched by all this Obamacare stuff. Mm. But they'll wind up paying it too. And I mean, it's crazy. It doesn't take $1,000 to make any medication.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of my medications is $192 every 2 months. And because of my race and my gender and because of the fact that I'm not officially poor, in other words, I'm not officially a welfare case, I am not entitled to any alleviation on that. And so I got to pay full whack. But
do you know why the medical profession jumped on, and especially the pharmaceutical companies jumped on treating AIDS? Mm. Because the AIDS drugs that they give to those people, they cost a fortune. Mm. The pharmaceutical industry has made an incredible amount of money treating this, quote, incurable disease.
Yeah, right. When I was here the first time around in 95 in Seattle, I worked for almost a year for a healthcare company whom I probably shouldn't name, but their unofficial slogan was, so-and-so healthcare, we'll keep you alive until your insurance runs out. And, well, that was not the official slogan, obviously, but as I was explained, as I was being given my orientation, I was actually working in the accounting department, but I was given a tour of the facility and everything by one of the head honchos when I came on there. And what he told me was, we're cashing in on the two major health disasters of the 20th century, AIDS and smoking. because what they provided was things like home hospice care for terminal AIDS patients and home oxygen for emphysema patients.
Right, right.
I didn't actually work the phones, and so this didn't apply to me, but the customer service representatives at that company who did work the phones and had to talk to people were told just before I left that they were going to be required to learn a foreign language because so many of the people that were calling, this was 20 years ago
no,
now,
no,
so
I
many of the
that.
People that were calling in didn't speak English. And somehow or other, I ended up on the list. I was told I had to sign up for it. I was having trouble calling down with the head office to the accounting people I dealt with because down there, it was in Los Angeles, and a lot of them were Mexicans who literally did not speak English. I mean, not just pigeon, you know, Jose Jimenez type. They just spoke no English at all.
Yeah.
And they wanted me to learn Spanish, but I had this objection to learning a non-white language. The only white language on that list of languages that our reps were supposed to learn was Russian. And so I told them I'd learn Russian, and so that's where I picked up my fragmentary smattering of Russian. But what was happening, and this was back in those days, even before Obamacare, was that these immigrants were coming over. They were getting one person legalized, or if they were Mexican, they were marrying a La Gorda, some big fat white girl who can't get a husband otherwise. And once they got one anchor, be it an anchor baby that was born there or one legalized green card alien who was anchored, so to speak, they started bringing in not just their uncles and cousins and 21 children and that sort of stuff, but the elderly people, the mamasans and that sort of stuff. And some of the languages like Vietnamese, Laotian. We were getting calls from 86-year-old Laotian Montagnard women who had spent all of their lives out in the hills of Laos dodging the Viet Cong. And they were now sitting in some little apartment in Seattle, Washington, paid for by the taxpayer. They didn't speak English, and they were calling us for help with their oxygen. And the liberals, I'm sure, would say, oh, this is just so wonderful. This is so humanitarian. But the whole thing was frankly shaped to be paid either by private health insurance, which is one of the reasons that private insurance is so damn high, and also by Medicare, Medicaid, that sort of stuff.
Sorry, but the whole thing is just a big scam. First off, cancer was a rare drug 100 years, or rare drug. It was a rare illness 100 years ago, right? If you got cancer, they'd ship you off to the local medical school to show you off to the students. And now it's like, what, 1 in 3 people are going to get cancer? Give me a break. I mean, obviously, it's some kind of environmental.
Yeah, it's because of all the crap we live in, all the toxic
exactly.
crap.
Exactly. And I was back in my hometown a couple of years ago, and I'm driving down the old highway through all these little, what used to be farming communities. And I swear there was a cancer institute or treatment center going up in every one of these rinky-dink towns in this rural state. And I'm like, it's incredible business. And then everybody dies anyway. But the racket is, first you get it, and then your insurance pays these horrendous costs for these medications that cost a fortune. And then when you finally use up your entire worldly wealth, then you're eligible for Medicaid, and then you get on that. And then the government, which is you and I, pay for the rest of the treatments until you die, which everybody does eventually. So much for that treatment. But anyway, it's just a scam to suck up more money.
Well, the reason that healthcare is so murderously expensive in this country, both sides have a little bit of it right, the left and the right. The left is right about one thing. A lot of it's greedy pharmaceutical companies and greedy medical supply companies and so forth and so on that charge $400 for a pill that costs them $1.29 to make. So a lot of it's that. But on the other hand, the right has it correctly when they say that 30 million illegal aliens using the emergency room as their primary care doesn't help. And never paying certainly doesn't help. I actually had to make a visit to the emergency room down in Astoria, Oregon many years ago. I was having a problem, which I won't get into, but I just wanted to actually be there in case the problem got bad because I didn't want to have to drive. And so, in essence, I was seen briefly by a doctor, wasn't even given any medication. I just basically sat in the emergency room in the waiting room area for about 3 hours until the problem settled down and I realized I was okay. And I went back home. They billed me $1,200 for that.
Oh, yeah.
Largely because there's just all these damn Mexicans that go into the emergency room and they just don't pay. And so the hospital has to, you know, I had an Anglo-Saxon name and I was an American and they figured, hey, this guy, we can chase him. And they ended up sending that to a collection agency.
Right.
I paid about half of it. And then I just said, hey, that's enough.
Well, there's a law that they cannot turn anyone away from an emergency room. And so pointless to send the bill to somebody that obviously can't speak English and isn't going to pay the bill anyway and doesn't have a known address. So why waste the paper? They send the bills to people that look like they might squeeze a few pennies out of them. But it's all back to the Obamacare. a system, you know, a Gold Rubberg device like our current medical system
Rube
is.
Rube Goldberg, you mean.
Oh, Rube
Goldberg. Rube Goldberg.
Okay, okay.
Who, by the way, was not a Jew. He was a Swede.
Okay, good for him. But anyway, the point is, it's not going to work. It's just, it's teetering as it is. They're barely keeping their nose above water as the pharmaceutical companies siphon off the money.
Mm-hmm.
It's just going to get worse now that they're adding millions of more people to the dole.
Mm-hmm. Well, what the Democrats are doing is deliberately creating an underclass, not just niggers and Mexicans as used to be the underclass, but a lot of impoverished and dispossessed whites now, many of whom are dependent on things like food stamps and Section 8 housing and welfare and Obama phones and that sort of stuff. In essence, all of this is to buy votes for the Democrats. And they do this not only through being sort of the paymaster, it's never a good idea to vote against the guy who signs your checks, but also to excite envy. And they claim that the Republicans are the party of the rich, which to a large extent, I'm sorry to say they are. The promise is always there, well, if you vote us in, keep on voting us in, we're going to take away all these Republicans' money and we're going to give it all to you. And that's, well, that's, and if you look at some of these websites I advise people to look at, like Huffington Post and Salon, that's what they say. I noticed this in Ireland. We're developing kind of an Irish attitude. They had a very big welfare culture there in Ireland, of course. It was a socialist country, and that was where I saw white second and third generation welfare families.
Yeah.
But I was told on more than one occasion that, you see, your typical American, if he's poor and he sees a guy driving by in a Cadillac and he's got nice clothes, wearing an Armani suit, and he's got a big cigar sticking out of his mouth, the American says, damn, look at that guy. How can I get what he has? The Irishman, when he sees the local business nabob driving by in his Mercedes with the or Louis Copeland suit and the cigar sticking out of his mouth, etc., etc., the Irishman says, ah, bloody hell, that bastard. How can I take away what he has and make him just as miserable as me? And it's a whole different attitude, and we're developing an Irish attitude towards that. Americans no longer aspire to become wealthy and successful. They aspire to take away the wealth and success from those who have it, so everybody's equally miserable. Let's see. I don't think I've played this one for a while. This is Nobody's Darling.
Well, yeah, that's true. But the sad thing is they're rapidly making white people a new permanent underclass.
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, the white middle class is now disappearing. The only remaining elements of the white middle class that have any wealth are basically late middle-aged and elderly people. Right. And you'll note that a lot of these things that you see going on the radio, like all these health seminars and buy gold and we're going to help you with your investments and all this sort of stuff and all these government programs and these secret taxes and they're doing things like going after 30-year-old Social Security debts from the descendants of people who allegedly owed them and things like that. All of this is aimed towards taking away the accumulated wealth of the white middle class, especially elderly white people, doing things like trying to confiscate 401ks, that sort of stuff. Because what's left of the white middle class are the last people in this country that have any wealth at all.
Yeah, they're the last people that got anything to steal. That's the whole problem. Right. The government and all the other vampires in this country have sucked the blood out of our economy to the point where they're broke, too. So they've already pissed off all the money they stole from us. And now they're busily trying to steal what's left. Mm-hmm. But trust me, they have pissed off all that money, all these idiotic wars and all the other stupid things we get involved in. It just sucks up an immense amount of capital. And you can just keep on printing money, paper money. Mm-hmm. But the point is, at some point, you're still going to have nothing left to eat.
Well, Paul Krugman says we can keep it up. Are you familiar with Paul Krugman, this Jew
who is kind of this
economic guru of the Democrats?
Yeah, right.
No, he seriously maintains that we can keep on doing what we're doing now. Basically lending out money and then printing more money to buy back the notes that we maintains that we can do this forever.
I mean, I don't know if they actually believe it, but that's been the party line, right? What I can't pronounce the guy's name, but Keynes.
Keynes, John Maynard Keynes.
Yeah, he's the guy that cooked this whole idea of deficit spending to plug the economy. And, you know, to a certain extent, it works. But the problem is, that's what our Uncle Adolf did over in Germany, right? When the bankers refused to loan him any money, he simply just created his own money out of thin air, but he based it on the
productivity of the German worker.
Exactly. And he didn't charge interest on it. But here, they just print money like crazy, and then they sell it to us. This is what's crazy. They sell us our own money and make us pay interest.
Right.
It's what my old man used to always talk about, compound interest. He said, that's the way to go. You know, loan some money at compound interest, and if you do the numbers, you know, within 20, 30 years, you basically own everything. Try a test.
Then you can convert to Judaism and put a yarmulke on your head.
Exactly. Yeah. Then you'll be welcomed with open arms, even if you are white.
Anyway, one thing you told me once, Charles, I know you live out in Montana and you're on a fairly elevated economic level and all that. Well, compared to most of us, you are. And you keep telling me that all these rich people have had enough and they're talking about, oh, they're going to do this and they're going to do that and it's time for a revolution, et cetera, et cetera. I am hearing this from a lot of people who have contact with upper middle class or affluent or frankly rich people, that they're really getting upset and angry and nervous that Obama's going to take what they have and they keep looking for a solution. But I can't persuade people to let them know that the party is here and that there is a solution.
Well, and that's why I was always hounding you to write more books, because once those books get in the public domain, you can't get them back again. And these people are pissed off, and they're not stupid. How do you think they got to be old people with reasonable amount of wealth to retire on? Because they worked their asses off, and they were smart. And they can see the country falling apart. These are business people. They can run the numbers as well as I can. So they know better than the lumpin' proletariat white man that the system's going to fall apart. They just don't know what to do. And they're pissed off. I mean, in private, they'll talk about saying the N-word. They talk shit about everybody now. From the government to all the other privileged classes, but they don't know what to do. And started handing out the brigade to people. Yeah, sure, it'll shock them at first, but a lot of people, I was surprised when I gave them the book. I thought, oh man, they're going to like, because I figured they were patriotards.
Call the FBI.
Yeah, exactly. Help. And actually, a lot of people write back and say, oh, wow, yeah, that's great. You got any more of those books? These are really very, very high-functioning people. You know, I have to admit, I was frankly terrified at first that it was just going to cause a shitstorm with my friends of mine. But I haven't got any flack from it at all. In fact, what I notice is that a lot of these people are getting more outwardly more radical than me. I'm always talking about radical stuff. But because of getting my ass kicked in the past by the spit liquor, well, they tried to do it, didn't work. But anyway, what I'm saying is these people, they don't know about the FBI and the spit liquors and all the other people that come out of the woodwork to make our lives miserable. So when they get awakened, they just go off, kind of like we did the first time we got awakened. We had no idea how much resistance we were going to get. But there's millions of these middle class people that know they're going to get sheared, and they just need some kind of blueprint.
Well, we've got the blueprint if we can just get it in front of them.
Yeah, just hand it out to people. What are they going to do? Call you a Nazi? Oh, no. A hater.
Yeah. Oh, you're a bigot.
Well, remember what my mama used to say. Sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me.
Yeah, I've gotten a little bit of, every now and then, some liberal or some Jew or whatever will get hold of one of my books and send me a nasty email about, oh, you're full of hate and all that sort of stuff. Not once. I'm thinking hard now here, and I think I'm telling the truth. Mm-hmm. Not once has anyone come to me about any one of my novels and said to me in shocked horror, but Harold, don't you realize this is treason against the United States? That idea honestly doesn't seem to bother anybody, even those that don't like the book. They don't like it because I talk bad about niggers and Jews. But the idea of being treasonous against this regime doesn't seem to bother anybody because everybody everybody knows that the government sucks.
No, it's trust me, everybody knows what's going on. They just don't know what to do. Yeah. And the thing of it is,
we do.
New people haven't been browbeaten and gotten fired from their jobs and all the other crap that we have to put up with. So, you know, we need some fresh blood, right?
I keep telling people they need to come here and live in communities.
Right.
I think now probably our biggest problem is that there are right now enough of us probably even listening to this podcast so that if we were all concentrated in the homeland and properly organized in given areas into teams or whatever or small communities, we would be able to get an actual revolution going. But I just can't seem to persuade white people of the necessity to live in communities. I don't know of any persecuted minority any time in history that did not band together and seek strength in numbers, except us.
Yeah, no, it's crazy.
I don't understand what's going on in our minds. Why would you want to continue sitting out there all alone with nothing but a computer for companionship? Why won't these people come to the Northwest and live among their own?
Yeah.
It's just bizarre. I have to admit, every time I think I finally got the white man's mentality taped, and I know why he's in such a horrible condition and maybe what to do about it, I'm proven optimistic. The Jews have just done a number on our brains, I tell you.
Somebody has. I still think it's the fluoride in the toothpaste, but I have never seen such passive people in my life. White people nowadays in the United States, it's just unbelievable.
Any other nation on the face of the earth, any other people on the face of the earth, black, white, brown, any place, if what has been done to us would have been done to them, they would have risen in armed revolt long ago. Nobody but white Americans would put up with the kind of treatment that we get from the government of the United States.
And they do it. They're doing it now. I mean, the Vietnamese did it. The Afghanis did it. The Iraqis. I mean, sure, we got superior firepower. We mowed them down by the thousands. But you insult people like that, they fight back. They don't care if you kill them. It's a situation of honor. They'd rather be dead than dishonored by a bunch of foreigners, right? Well, it's like the average American, except for the soldiers who are willing to go over there and get their asses shot off to protect us. And what do? We sit here and we're too bloody chicken shit to even talk to our neighbors or hand out a book. I mean,
Right.
I'll stop that.
I think you're right. White Americans just have no sense of personal honor anymore.
Yeah, and the only ones with honor join the military. And the rest of us just sit on our goddamn asses.
Basically, white males have become consumer animals, herd animals.
They are.
We're what they call in zoology circles, we're what they call ruminants. We're grazers.
Yeah, exactly. Guess what happens to ruminants?
Well, I think we're going to be eating one tonight. Okay,
that's
all I've got. That's all I've got.
I just wanted to put that plug in that the soldiers are the only brave people left in this country. But it's true. They are.
Okay. Anything else?
Okay. No, that's it. I'm going to...
So our time is up now. And that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sascha Andaban. Freedom.